Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome a great guest co-host, Dr. Nathan Sison from UNC Family Medicine. Welcome, Nathan.
Thanks for having me.
We've got some incredible research that matters today, and we have a great guest today, Dr. Nancy Toms, who has done research on the history of the American patient. I'm looking forward to that. First, though, let's talk about some research that matters. And this is actually an important problem that really affects across generations because it's families who have someone in their family who has dementia, which might be just about every American.
Yeah. At some point, you will probably take care of someone who is demented.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, I had a mother who had vascular dementia, and I was really involved in taking care of her for some of the last years of her life. And there were lots of things, even for a family doctor, that were difficult to know fully the scope of everything that I was dealing with. And this is some research that really says maybe this is more of a universal need and concern.
Sure. This is qualitative research out of the United Kingdom that says exactly what you said, Dr. Goldstein, that more caregivers for folks who are demented need more support and better education about how to take care of their loved ones.
Yeah, they did kind of structured discussions with, it sounds like, both family members and maybe even providers of those who had dementia and said, you know, it's not just knowing what the definitions are, but it's like, what's going to happen in the future? How quickly is this going to happen? What are all the different behaviors, like when your loved one gets agitated or can't sleep or has some delusion or hallucination or a side effect from a medication? What about the financial issues? What about the legal issues? There's a lot of things.
It is a lot of things. And all of that is complicated by the fact that your loved one is suffering or seemingly suffering before you and all the emotional distress that comes with that.
And sometimes caregivers actually can suffer depression and stress and anxiety because they feel like maybe they're not doing the right things or maybe they're just tired because of how difficult it is. And so this type of support they're talking about really is important. How would you, in your practice, think about maybe making this type of research more real to you and those who you interact with who may be taking care of people with Alzheimer's or dementia?
I think it starts with having a good family doctor who takes care of both the caregiver and the patient and providing them with not only the medical resources and the home health and those things, but paying attention to their mental health and their own well-being as well.
Yeah, I think like checking in on a caregiver, like, I know your mom's probably doing okay and we've been talking right about her. I want to really check in on you. You're not my patient. Maybe you are my patient, but I want to check in on you and I want to talk about it. I want to make sure you have resources that you need because I know how important and valuable your work is.
That's right. And talking with caregivers about what they can expect going forward because sometimes things come as a surprise to people.
Yeah. Talking about coming as a surprise, our next research that matters probably wouldn't be a surprise to a lot of people. Have you ever had a dog bite, Nathan?
I have.
Yeah, me too. And it seemed like it was small dog and a big dog. One of them was our dog that kind of got kind of more aggressive when they got older. And another was a small dog of a neighbor who maybe they say, maybe I was anxious. Is that what this research is about?
It is. It's exactly what it's about. It's saying that if you are anxious, it is more likely that you will get bitten by a dog.
This was a study out of Northern England of 700 people, and they were kind of looking at who had been bitten by a dog, did they know the dog that bit them, and the severity of the bites. And they gave everyone a personality test. And they basically said the more you were kind of emotionally stable – I'm not sure I like that term, but that's what they used – then the less likely they were to be bitten by dogs. So I don't know if that means that I'm emotionally unstable. A lot of people might wonder about that. But it seemed also that they were blaming sometimes either the dog or the patient. And I'm not sure I like that.
Yeah, I tend to blame people more than dogs often.
But well, it can go both ways. But it would suggest, I mean, a lot of people are really fearful of dogs to the point of, you know, the dog comes up to me, it can be the nicest dog in the world, but they're really, really fearful. That's a hard thing to sometimes undo, particularly if they've been bitten before.
It is. It is. And I think this just speaks to the level that dogs are attuned to our own emotions, good or bad.
Yeah, also the people who had several dogs were much more likely to be bitten than if you didn't have a dog. I'm like, if you didn't have a dog, you don't have interactions with dogs, you may not get bitten. Well, that kind of research, we might say, is not as bone deep as our next research, which is about the relationship between some bones and heart disease. Did I got that right, Nathan?
That's right. This one is new to me.
It was new to me as well, but we both like looked at each other and we go, this is important. It's, and just for our listeners know, it's rare for two doctors who read about research to both read new research and go, huh, maybe important. What are we even talking about here?
We are talking about something called CHIP, which is a medical acronym for clonal hematopoiesis of indeterminate potential. And what it seems like is that there are certain cells in the bones. These cells are stem cells, which make other types of cells that become blood cells that start to show evidence of cancer. And then the patient does not get cancer, but becomes more prone to heart attacks later in life.
And this seems to be maybe an independent risk factor. So for people who don't have risk factors for heart disease, but yet who maybe sometimes could have sudden death or have a heart attack, this may be one of the factors that puts them at risk. I think that it increases with age. So 20% of people in their 60s might have this CHIP, this clonal hematopoiesis of indeterminate potential. Call it CHIP, too hard to call otherwise. But up to 50% of people in their 80s. Now, that seems like, well, we should all go out and get tested for CHIP. What's wrong with that?
We have no treatment for CHIP. Or we do not know what that means clinically. For instance, we don't know that if you or I had this problem, how we could mitigate the risk or reduce the risk, or what even to tell a patient who has it, other than they have that risk.
Yeah, and so this research was actually done up in Massachusetts. It's involved some of the major health centers in the country. And so we know it's something important, but we don't know if we have a treatment for it yet. Could people get tested for it if they were worried? Do they have some risk factors? They could get tested. It might cost them a lot of money, and it's not going to be paid for by insurance.
Yeah.
But stay tuned.
Definitely stay tuned.
Our last research that matters is about toys and expectations for young children, young boys, and young girls. What are we talking about?
We're talking about the pink and blue and how those colors, at least in the Western world, have been connected to the female and male gender.
And this was actually an article that was in a journal called Sex Roles, and it was done by two researchers from the University of Hong Kong with 129 preschool Chinese children between 5 and 7. And they were kind of seeing to what extent some of this color preference for pink or blue was a learned behavior, so that once the male child knows that blue is kind of what young boys should like, they start looking for and liking blue toys, which are marketed more towards young boys, and the converse would be pink, which suggests, though, that that also has ramifications for kind of what they end up liking and doing, irrespective of whether or not that's true.
That's right. And they also showed that it's a completely arbitrary color. They could pick any color they want and get that same association between boys and girls.
So if I'm a parent out there and I'm thinking, I don't really want this stereotype to be just ingrained in my child at a young age, what do we do?
Let the kids play with whatever toys they want.
Right. And maybe look for toys that are not necessarily the color that says for young boys.
Right.
The blue truck that says for young boys.
Exactly.
Well, that'll conclude our research that matters. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we're going to be talking with Dr. Nancy Toms about her research into the history of the American patient. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Nathan Seisen. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health. This is Dr. Adam Goldstein, and today on Conversations, I'm talking with historian Dr. Nancy Toms about her book, a wonderful, amazing book called Remaking the American Patient, and kind of the history of the American patient and everything that's happened over the last 100 years in healthcare and medicine. Welcome, Dr. Toms.
Oh, great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into your book. How did you get interested in healthcare and social and medical history?
Complete serendipity. I stumbled into it. I went to graduate school to study the history of women in the family, and one of my profs there just turned out to be the leading historian of American medicine in the world. He was just amazing. And he got me a job working in one of the oldest hospitals in the United States, the Pennsylvania Hospital, and I was just in love from the minute I walked into that old place. And I haven't looked back since.
What was the thing that was passionately appealing in which you have drawn energy for to write numerous books?
What fascinated me most was the doctor-patient relationship. So everything I did, starting with my graduate school work, was something about how doctors and patients understand each other, how they interact. So that's been a thread that's pretty much been through everything that I've done.
Well, we know that virtually every person in American society certainly would have interacted as a patient at one time with the doctor. And so it's a universal element. I think what makes it interesting is a subtitle of your book is how Madison Avenue and modern medicine turned patients into consumers. If I were writing the book, that wouldn't have been the first thing that came to my mind, that someone would have subtitled it. Tell us how this whole piece, because this shapes how you talk about remaking the American patient.
It's funny that you bring that up, that my editor is listening. When they came up with that subtitle, I was like, well, that's not really what the book is about. It was a subtitle they thought would draw in more readers. Certainly there is a lot in my book about advertising, and I am obsessed with why in the United States we call patients consumers. You know, that's not common in other parts of the world. It's a really pretty unique American take on things. But was it only advertising and modern medicine that brought this about? It is more complicated.
Well, I know we're going to get into some of that complexity, but it's interesting, the shift from patients to consumers. I wonder if that's like physicians to providers or some other non-clinical. And I know we have providers who are non-physicians, but I wonder if there's a consumer term for physicians that moves us into something that's not where it historically was.
You've hit the nail on the head. The consumer provider language is a language that came out of economics. It's taken on ethical and moral aspects when we think about patients' rights to be informed. Those have been modeled on consumer bills of rights. The sort of patients, the first patients' bills of rights that come out in the 1970s were modeled on the famous speech that President John Kennedy gave in 1963 that laid out consumers' rights to be informed, to be in charge. It was a movement of that language into healthcare that really made this language of the consumer start to become more common. And then, as you point out, the medical analog to that is the doctor becomes a provider.
I wonder if we maybe start with the remaking of the American patient. What did patient care look like, according to your work, 50, 70 years ago, 25 years ago, and how does that compare to it looks today? Are we dealing with the same things as patients going in to see physicians and other providers?
One of the most surprising things to me in doing this work was how relevant I found the old stuff to be. There have been extraordinary changes in terms of the technologies that we can take advantage of, the drugs that we have available, but some of the basic challenges that we space in communication, in what the doctor needs to share with the patient and what the patient needs to understand. It's amazing to me how far back those dynamics go, and I was surprised to find that there were patients taking a more, what we would think, engaged or activist point of view with their doctors long before I thought they should be doing that. I mean, I'm a kid of, you know, the 60s and the 70s. To me, it all started, you know, in the 1970s with my generation, the baby boomers. I was amazed to find out that in my parents' and grandparents' generation, there were also, not a lot, but there were definitely some patients who were starting to ask questions of their doctor and to want to be more of a partner than somebody just being told what to do. I didn't anticipate that.
How did you find out that? I mean, it doesn't really surprise me that people don't necessarily want to be told always what to do. But we've always heard, well, we had that age of paternalism where the doctor, who typically was male 5 decades ago, would to tell the patient what to do. How did you find out that this wasn't always the case?
Once you start looking for it, it leaps out of medical journals, it leaps out of newspapers and popular magazines. Where I originally found it was in discussions of advertising and its impact on patients. That doctors were concerned that there was a lot of drug advertising. It wasn't for prescription drugs back in the day, but it was for things like Geritol. And that doctors are really concerned that people needed to understand that not everything you could buy in the drugstore was good for you, that you shouldn't believe everything you hear. Back then it was on the radio. Today we would say it's on your television or your internet. That in order to be a healthy person in the United States, you had to learn to triage the huge volume of commercial advertising being beamed at you, you know, like every minute. So that's where I originally found it, was people not being so much critical initially of doctors, but of drug companies, drug stores, and their advertising. But what I discovered is that once these people started looking at drug ads and drug stores, they started thinking and getting information that then also went over into their doctor's office. So they would find out things about drug X that when they went to the doctor's office, if the doctor was recommending that, they would say, well, what about the side effects? What about this? What about that? It kind of started this cross-fertilization. And a lot of physicians, on the one hand, they wanted their patients to be critical when they were in the drugstore, but they didn't want them to carry that over into the doctor's office. But it was really hard to keep that from happening. Specialization really takes off in the United States very early compared to Europe in the same time period. So people started having to choose whether or not to go to a specialist or a general practitioner, especially in big cities. This consumer stuff I'm talking about, it was a big city survival strategy, far less common, you know, in rural areas where you didn't have as many doctors to choose from.
Well, and I imagine a lot of the trends that you have uncovered and talk about have disproportionately started in urban areas, but I would imagine over time they also do impact rural areas. And the one that I might think about is large pharmacies. We probably in rural areas and maybe around the country, you had the small pharmacy, and you talk about this at the beginning of your book. I would imagine even in many rural areas of the United States today, you do have big pharmacy chains.
Yes, absolutely. And the rise of a more corporate kind of, both in the pharmaceutical industry, and then inevitably it started to affect medicine as well, is a big part of the story I tell. The more you get kind of national advertising campaigns, you know, from the 1980s on, you start to get integration of hospital and physician practice groups, a kind of networking that really, you know, in the olden days, you had a solo practitioner kind of doctor, and that kind of I think, moderated a lot of the concerns people had about, usually was it his behavior. But, you know, by the 1980s, especially when managed care starts to come into the picture, the old argument that doctors are not business people, that they really live outside the corporate world, that really starts becoming harder and harder to make that argument. I see spillover of criticisms that people have of pharmaceutical companies. If doctors appear to be too much influenced by, say, detailing and other pharmaceutical practices, it feeds into this patient concern that, well, you know, I'd better get extra drug information to make sure that a generic wouldn't be better for me. That kind of thinking.
Well, we're going to really pick up on this and some of the advertising work and the intersection of these worlds just after a break. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to continue our conversation talking with Dr. Nancy Toms about her book, The History of the American Patient. We'll be right back with Your Health. This is Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Adam Goldstein, and you're listening to Your Health. And we're talking with historian Dr. Nancy Toms about her new book, Remaking the American Patient. And Nancy, right before the break, we were really talking, and you were helping us understand how this trend towards specialization started a long time ago and probably accelerated, and wasn't just in providers. It was pharmacies getting bigger. And I wonder, when this concept of too big to fail started, that we continue to have bigger healthcare systems because that's how the organizations make their living.
The idea that in order to get better medicine in the United States, we have to make it more open to market competition is an idea that really catches on in the 1970s. Before that, there's kind of a strong belief, even among economists, that medicine is just different. You can't sell healthcare like you can a box of cereal or, you know, a television set. But with the rising healthcare costs in the 1970s, this more economic way of, or the idea that the way to bring down prices is to have more competition, really comes into favor among policymakers. It's not in favor among physicians. But basically, this gets, I would say, rammed down their throats because of the third-party payer. A lot of this is driven by insurance and the way we reimburse our providers by fee-for-service as opposed to a more holistic way of paying for care. The more health insurance driven we get, and that's something that is there by the 1950s and just steadily ramps up into the 1970s, the more we get driven by this system of insurance, the more incentives there are to try to control costs. But then one way you control costs is by getting bigger economies of scale. So the drive that we've seen, and this starts in the 1980s, and it's just, you know, galloping ahead, even in rural areas, that these kind of mega hospital chains that are also control really access to physicians, it's a way of trying to stay afloat in this more challenging economic climate.
Well, one of the things that I noticed when I was in my training and new to practice was when the direct-to-consumer advertising for prescription drugs was really starting. And I remember the conversations with colleagues like, is this good for patients or not? Well, it really didn't matter what we thought too much because it was the genie with the bottle open and it was rampant. And that has only accelerated over the last couple decades. Talk about that from your perspective, and what do we learn from it?
It's a good example of how you can say we have a more market-oriented kind of medicine, but it's not necessarily what either doctors or patients wanted. There is a huge discussion of direct-to-consumer advertising in the 1980s, and consumer group after consumer group weighed in and said, don't do it. Physicians, pharmacists weighed in and said, don't do it. Even some pharmaceutical companies said, we're not sure this is a good idea because, you know, it might debase the public's opinion of ethical pharmaceutical companies, because what made them ethical was they didn't advertise on television. Well, the profit motive overcame that sense of caution. And in fact, there are studies that suggest that the shift to direct-to-consumer advertising has hurt public trust in the pharmaceutical industry. And you can find pharmaceutical executives today who will say, it was a bad idea. We wish we hadn't done it. The problem is, as you put it, once a genie is out of the bottle, even the executives who said in the 80s, I don't want to do this, said, but if Company X starts to do it, I will too. Same with hospital advertising. I mean, that's been around a lot longer than direct-to-consumer, but the amount of money that we're now pouring into it, again, it's part of this getting too big to fail and trying to outcompete the other hospital provider network in your neighborhood. I'll have better ads, and, you know, they'll come to Mount Sinai or to Stony Brook first, and it's, boy, a very advertising is a really big piece of this story.
We're talking with Dr. Nancy Toms, author of Remaking the American Patient. And Nancy, what's just come through is something that I think is really a universal part of your narrative, is remaining skepticism that today many patients, maybe many doctors, have about the healthcare system. Can you talk about, and maybe you have an example of from your work or life about how that plays out, and then we'll talk about what you recommend.
If you ask most people what they want from their physician is high-quality care. Focusing only on the cost of that care often doesn't get to what it is that people want. One of the problems with the way the idea of consumerism has worked in the past 20 years is it's really been harnessed to this idea of bringing down costs, because that's what everybody's worried about so much. But trying to get patients to think about what their care costs, they don't determine those costs. They don't decide what the MRI is going to cost. They don't decide what their doctor charges for an office visit. So I think that looking only at consumers have to become more aware of what their care costs and try to find it cheaper has not been a very effective way of dealing with the side effects of this new system that we've evolved into.
How then has writing this book altered your own views of your own healthcare needs?
It made me very aware of how privileged I was to have a good group health insurance program and to be more aware of the plight of people who don't have that advantage. So it's really made me understand more why having so many people without good health insurance has become such a problem in the United States, and why it's causing, I mean, so much anguish even at this moment. It's really made me doubt what I was told as a kid, that American medicine was the best in the world. I now go regularly and talk to physicians in Europe, in the Netherlands in particular, and let me tell you, it really shakes your American exceptionalism to see what they're able to do without the same kind of hyper-profit-driven system and with universal coverage.
I guess one question I'd like to know, just from your perspective, because 50, 60 years ago, we didn't have things called electronic health records. We clearly do now. And it seems that what you talk about is kind of the pitfalls and the promise of change. What can we learn from that journey that you so well describe in your book about where electronic health records might be today and 20 years from now?
Great question. We've often looked to new information technologies to get us out of our healthcare fixes. I think that the whole internet revolution and the wired patient, there's a lot of potential there for better communication, but it's not a magic bullet. It's not going to solve all the problems, say, over the way we price our healthcare and the tilt toward specialized care, procedure-based medicine. Family physicians should make more money than they do. And if our system rewarded doctors who talk to their patients and took their care in a more holistic frame, if they got paid more, that would really, really help. But we don't have a system that rewards doctors who talk and who care about their patients. It does the opposite.
Well, we're fortunate here at the University of North Carolina that our press published your book. We're really excited that. And I also must say that my colleagues in the Department of Family Medicine here and the residents that we get still have the altruism, still believe in the sanctity of that doctor-patient relationship. So sometimes it feels like we're fighting against that tide.
You.
But I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Your Health and sharing your time, expertise, and passion.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Nancy Toms about her new book about the American patient. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be answering questions about your health. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health for the House Call segment of our show today. Nathan and I are going to talk about your health questions and concerns. Nathan, if a listener would like us to address any health concern on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And I'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today about a parent who's concerned about their son with acne.
My son is on an antibiotic for acne, but he's horrible about taking it consistently. Obviously, his acne does not clear up like we want it to as a result. What are some other treatment options that teens are more apt to follow?
Well, this is a difficult issue, even though it seems straightforward, because we know that if the teen uses some of the medications or some of the treatments that we prescribe, they are likely to get better. What's the problem here, Nathan?
They're still a teenager, and all medications require some sort of regimen and taking every day or at least regularly.
Yeah, particularly for the acne medicines. I'm not really aware of medicines like you could get by taking them one time a week or once a month. That actually would be a great place to spend money in research and development, because that would make a lot of our patients, probably including me, more likely to use them. And we have some medicines like that. You take an antibiotic for 5 days. Some antibiotics, they'll stay in your system for 10 days. But this particular issue is not one that, you know, matter of fact, one of the problems is you take the medicines, your acne gets better, and then it gets worse.
Exactly. And it's an antibiotic, and antibiotics classically do not have much effect if you continue taking them and start and stop and take them in an irregular way.
One of the things I do like to recommend is that, you know, if there is a medicine that you're giving twice a day and you can give it once a day, that's a good thing. And there are some antibiotics that you could give once a day rather than twice a day. A lot of times people put creams on and they'll give two or three different types of creams, some in the morning, some in the evening. I can tell you, teenagers aren't going to use two or three different types of creams, you know, and remember to do that. A third piece, though, is to actually really work with your teen to understand what sort of things they could do. Work with what they can do rather than focusing on what they may have a hard time doing. There well may be certain foods that they could avoid that may be worse. We could work on picking behavior. Sometimes in the teens that can do that. And sometimes rather than two creams, they might actually take one pill.
Yeah. Other things you could try is setting reminders on the phone or even having them take it at school where it's supervised by a nurse.
Yeah. So, you know, this is hard, but having your teen take control of their own health? Because the other question is, how much does it bother them? It may bother you more than it bothers them, in which case, see what he wants to do.
Yeah, it's up to him ultimately.
Thank you for that good house call question. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My doctor recently changed her schedule and is now available only on days of the week that are really inconvenient for me. I love seeing her and resistant to changing doctors, but I'm also managing multiple chronic health issues and need to be able to see her fairly regularly. Do you see any ways to make it work?
Well, it depends on like how restrictive her schedule is. I mean, if she's only available on Tuesday mornings and Thursday afternoons... And there are, particularly maybe in an academic health center, there may be providers like that. That could really be a problem, particularly if you have long hours working on Tuesday mornings and Thursday afternoons. Some people work night shifts and they don't want to come in the afternoon. That's the only time they can sleep.
Right. And most doctors, or at least large institutions or large practices, have expanded hours and flexible hours for patients. It looks like in this case, if what we're reading here is the case where the doctor really isn't able to make the time to see the patient based off their schedules, maybe seeing somebody else in the practice might be the best move.
Yeah, particularly if you have lots of needs. Sometimes I'll say maybe there's a team that can take care of you, two or three doctors. You know, people
right.
who both get to all know you a little bit, so therefore you feel comfortable if you can't see your doctor seeing someone else that you've seen before. It requires actually probably, you know, better communication. And then finally, sometimes I tell patients, you know, I may not be in clinic that day, but I'll see you if I need to.
Yeah. Exceptions are always made.
You know, just call me. I'll get you in. And we can work. Sometimes working outside the system works just as well as working within a system.
Yeah. The doctors value the relationships they've built with patients just as much as patients value their doctors. So I think there's probably a way to make it work.
Thank you for the question, Laura. What's our very next house call?
My 18-year-old daughter has ADHD and is going off to college in the fall. Is there anything we can start doing now to prepare her to focus and succeed in this new environment?
Well, this is a really important issue because all of a sudden the expectations are going to be even higher, but it's going to be up to her a lot of the management. You won't be there to help her.
Yeah. That's the big difference between high school and college, is all of a sudden the schedule becomes more of your own doing.
You know, one of the things I like to say is, first off, help set her up for success. So one thing that a lot of parents may not think about is you can petition and get her more time on tests so that rather than having an hour to maybe take the test, she has 2 hours to take the test rather than being in a room with 30 other people where every click of the pen, every time someone blinks, you go look at them, and you could go take the test in a room that's private and quiet. These are some reasonable accommodations if you have diagnosed attention deficit hyperactivity disorder that a psychologist or even your family doctor maybe help you get that could be really important to success during those 4 years.
It is, and those resources are out there, and all you have to do is ask usually.
You know, certainly medication. And one of the important things is probably if you're going to be on medication, you're in college and you're away from home, is to have a therapist that you can get the medicines from because it may not be convenient to come back. So going to student help, getting early on relationships with those who prescribe these medicines. I'm sure there's a lot of behavioral techniques that also would be important. I'm not sure they'd be unique to college, but I would imagine things like that could make it worse, like alcohol that may be more frequent in college, would be things to be aware of too.
Yeah, absolutely. And the lack of structure in college could also work to her benefit as well, where kids in high school with ADHD often have a lot of trouble sitting still in that structured environment, and she could use her own techniques at her own will to do better at school.
Good luck in college. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed questions and stories that are important to your health. You can send your own questions to yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter or Facebook or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank my great guest co-host, Dr. Nathan Sisson, and our guest today,
Dr. Nancy Toms.
We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Nathan Sisson.
And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.